what did you gain from the military that has helped you now in spreading a message of peace?
I'm certain that war is terrible and we ought not to ever do it again. And I'm certain that taxation is theft and that if I need alms, I can get them from my neighbors who like me because I've been nice to them or who pity me because something bad happened in my life. And so that certainty that people are good and that I'll be able to get along if only I try to get along, that means that I never need to pick up the sword or the knife or the gun again. And I never need to ask anyone else to do it on my behalf. I approve of Prometheus for teaching people how to use fire. I approve of, you know, gun instructors for teaching people self-defense. Those people are beyond reproach. Nobody can say anything bad about a gun instructor unless they're a bad teacher. But cops and soldiers don't have clean hands. That includes me. And so, to wash my hands of it, I have to tell the truth about how I feel about what I saw. And so many people saw that, thanks to the internet, thanks to blogs, thanks to the fiction that I see some veterans writing. We have this opportunity to study war as an idea, not a thing that we really do. It's like football. We can put it in a box, we can contain it. We can call it an emergency kit plan that we're never going to use. And the way that we do it is the people who mean it, you let them tell you about it, and you listen to their authority. The centurions were the ones who came to Jesus first. The veterans are the ones who came to Ron Paul first. Everybody else is going to need to come around. They're going to need to support our troops after the fact. Because my generation's not going to be a Vietnam generation. We have the internet. We know how to read and write. We have Western civilization. We have liberal educations. It would be a real pity if two generations of veterans in a row went, I don't want to say to waste, I mean, there's so many wonderful people, but if there were two tragedies in a row, if we didn't have one of them be a comedy where we say, hey, I'm glad we got over that, that'd be nice. That'd be a good story. I'd like to write that one.
Hey everyone, this is Carlos Morales, and this is the Libertarian Atheist Podcast. Find everything at libertarian-atheist.com, and make sure to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you are presently using. First off, I'd like to say thanks to everyone who's listened to and shared episodes from our series on Islam. The most recent show, Muhammad, the Man, the Myth, the Conqueror, ended up being shared and commented on quicker than anything I've produced since my series on Child Protective Services. The responses to it, though, not so surprisingly, have been passionate on both sides. Many loving how thorough the research was, the amount of time explaining the importance of knowing the history and teachings of the religion, and how the message was made clear. War and the initiation of coercion cannot solve the issue of jihadism. Today we'll be joined by a man who saw firsthand why this doesn't work. Josh Holmes is a two-tour veteran of the Iraq War and a recipient of the Combat Infantryman's Badge. I met Josh through the Free State Project, where he works to spread the message of liberty and one of the most important lessons anyone should know. How to protect yourself. I'm very excited to have him on, so let's get on with it. Alrighty, Josh, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, sir. So recently we were kind of having a conversation regarding what you saw in Iraq, and I started, you know, I've known you for quite a while, but I've kind of known you as a libertarian anarchist who is well-versed on the topic of liberty and philosophy and law. And, you know, it's weird to me to even think of you as a person that would have willingly went to war against another group in the name of freedom. How did you actually end up getting involved was it the army?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with the army originally.
I think that the credit probably belongs to my Boy Scout leaders, because while the army might not be, well, the army is not good for anyone, a lot of people can get past a lot of the damage that they endure in the army and go on to do very good things. And working with young people is one of the best things that I think you can do, because that's what's had the most influence in my life, is the people who took the extra time for me. The biggest person in my life, my most important scout leader, was a Vietnam veteran, and he suffered stoically through health problems that were caused, I think, by exposure to Agent Orange, if I understand right. But he was a great man. And whatever it was in his past didn't stop him.
And so you ended up signing up at what age?
I signed up the week before I turned 18.
So you were still in high school?
Yep.
Was there any kind of propaganda leaders at the high school who were trying to get kids to join?
No, they have a really weak effort, I think, up here. I think they do a much better job in...
In New Hampshire, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm originally from Manchester, New Hampshire. I grew up right here. So I don't think that the public school had a lot to do with it, except that it didn't prepare me for anything else except for an institutional life. Public school didn't prepare me for the kind of creative life that I live right now. It prepared me for the regimentation that I have, or that I had in the Army. But what really pushed me in was the Boy Scouts, because I was so well prepared for a career in the Army that I knew it would be easy. And the idea that it would be easy, that hubris, it propelled me on to make terrible choices because I was young and inclined to make bad choices by going too fast, you know, flying too close to the sun. And because I had all the training to be in the Boy Scouts, but I didn't have the underlying moral foundation necessary to understand why war is bad at a fundamental level, I made the wrong choice because I had the wrong fundamental principles.
You stated that you signed up whenever you're 18. Yeah. What year was that?
I enlisted at the end of 2004, but I didn't actually physically enter service until 2005.
So we were already 2 years into the Iraq War, correct?
Yes. Yeah, when we invaded Iraq, I think I was a sophomore in high school, because I remember the year between sophomore and junior year, that summer, I heard a lot of news about the Iraq War, that I was living on a Boy Scout camp, so all I had was the newspaper, and so it was all bad news, but it was very exciting.
So you thought of it as an exciting idea, essentially the idea of being able to jump in there and fight guys.
It is good versus evil. I mean, if it's if my memory serves, I think it was Uday Hussein was the son of Saddam who tortured the Olympians to make them perform better. If that's true and not propaganda, then my malice towards that and my desire to attack that is easy.
Oh, I mean, Uday was absolutely horrific. I mean, the sons of Saddam, I mean, they took the wives away from husbands who they just got married to and raped them in front of them and then killed the husband. I mean, there were some really horrific incidences that were occurring, which, of course, I mean, as I kind of outlined in the last episode, Muhammad did similar actions. So I can completely understand looking at the dictator of that area and looking at the culture that was kind of being pushed in those areas as certainly being evil.
Mm-hmm.
So you were thrown into a training camp, I'm guessing. So that was around, what, 2000?
That was the summer of 2005 that I started my basic training.
And what were they kind of, what kind of information were they inundating you with?
Mainly, it was a nuts and bolts preparation for the job of doing low-intensity combat. Imagine that in Vietnam, they figured out they couldn't just take hills away from people and win. They had to actually maintain a presence and work with, or, you know, in conjunction with a community to basically be the guy on the block that everybody allows to carry a gun with swagger and everybody doesn't put up with anybody else. And so when they brought that concept back to the LAPD SWAT, and they came up with a way of interacting with an extremely dangerous environment with a kinetic solution, they became addicted to the hammer and looking at every problem as a nail. And they started what we have now is the one SWAT raid every so often. I mean, I can't remember the number off the top of my head, and I don't want to make it up, but Radley Palko at Reason, or formerly at Reason, has some great stuff on it. And when I was in the Army, a big part of my job was to kick in people's doors and intimidate them into letting us search through their stuff to see if they had contraband. I don't see a difference between that and local law enforcement.
Which, it's not really a surprise that the police are trying to get people who are former military, correct, right now?
You know, it makes a kind of sense that that's a thing to be worried about, but, and it might just be biased because it's my own group, I have more trust for the members of my own peer group in terms of their ability to use force, because in Iraq, we weren't in the kind of consequence-free environment that I feel police operate in today. And that's probably got a lot to do with the bias, because when I was in the military, I felt like my military superiors were over my head and breathing down my neck, and that prevented me from ever doing anything wrong. With that said, I'm certain that tens of thousands of Iraqis were killed needlessly, and no one was punished for it, and so we're not holding ourselves to the same standard that we'd want to hold others to. And if I say that that's true about the police, only I say that the numbers are smaller, I don't feel like I'm exaggerating.
So what were kind of the sights and smells that you first remember from getting in, after getting into Iraq?
Well,
I know that's an odd question, but it's just kind of creating the scenery. I can remember, you know, when I was a Child Protective Services investigator, seeing the impoverished households, the weird, how impoverished areas always seem to have pregnant dogs walking everywhere. You'd walk into a home that would smell like someone had freshly just taken a dump on the floor, yet they had a 70-inch flat-screen television in the middle of the house.
Oh, no.
With no food to feed anyone. Obviously, it's going to be different in Iraq.
Oh, no. This is... I've got to say, that's love your enemy is easy when the people that you're supposed to hate have quiet dignity. Because Iraq is actually not, as a Muslim country as they go, it seems very secular. I spent 22 or 3 months in Iraq, and I think I saw 2 prayers the whole time I was there. 2 people actually doing the prayers that I understand they're supposed to do 5 times a day. And I heard the call to prayer sometimes in some towns, but it's not a universal thing, and I never saw anybody respond to it. In the same way, in the army, on a base, when they play reveille in the morning, you know, and they're pulling the flag up, you're supposed to stand and salute if you're outdoors. So everyone makes an effort to avoid being outdoors, so they won't have to salute just to get out of it. It's like going to church. If you had to go to church 5 times a day, you'd come up with a way to get out of it. And
yeah,
my experience on the ground with Iraqis is they don't care. But as far as the way that their homes are, they're shabby because they were constructed so long ago and because they're in disrepair. But that's the same thing with these old New England houses. Every single Southern carpenter that you and I know has made fun of these New England houses.
Yep.
That every house is out of square. And the reason is they're 115 years old or more. Of course they're out of square. They're still here.
Yeah.
That's what they've got to brag about. And the Iraqis that I met, they have next to nothing, but they have dignity and they have their families together. I'm not going to pretend like they're enlightened parents the way that, you know, you'd want if you were trying to raise extremely peaceful people, but neither are Americans peaceful people, so who am I to judge?
How long did you buy into the mythos that there was going to be weapons of mass destruction that were going to be found by one of the...
Oh my goodness, that was the first time that I found out I was terribly wrong, was I arrived in Iraq in 2006. And eventually I got up the courage to ask about this thing that I heard about on TV, but I didn't know anything about and was kind of scary. I had a protective mask for chemical weapons and so on, and I had no idea whether I had it for a very good reason or if it was just something I had. And I was looked at like I was an idiot. Nobody believed that bull.
Really?
We were just cops on a beat. By 2006, when I arrived, I showed up to a unit that had been there a while. They'd had people hurt. They'd had people leave. I was a replacement for somebody. And I was just this new idiot, you know. I believed what was on TV, and that was an awfully silly thing to do.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating, though. By 2006, you're already kind of in that position.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I was about 19 years old. 2006, so I was already kind of doing the protests and the war. I wasn't really buying into any of the ideas of the propaganda they were pushing towards us. But even if they had kind of WMDs, I still really wasn't too concerned with it. Now, I kind of bought into the leftist propaganda that you know, Islamic radicalism was purely based off of Western imperialism, and it's because of a blowback theory that everything that's going on there as far as radical Islam is concerned is purely because Americans keep bombing those areas.
See, I do subscribe to that theory. I mean, there are other problems that I see that I'm not... I understand that, you know, having central banking run the world is oppressive to people economically.
Yeah.
And that they ought to want to resist that just because they have dignity and they'd like to run their own lives. That makes sense to me. And so wanting to use violence to resist that... Other cultures deal with political problems in different ways, and it's sort of like Game of Thrones. If we're going to be Westerners and we're going to basically be upset with people for chopping heads off 60 or 80 times a year the way the Saudi Arabians do, and I don't think that they ought to do it, and maybe I'm wrong about the number.
But no, it's staggering how many people the Saudis are doing
in. I'm not versed in it because I don't think that it's really worth my concern considering how many people get droned per year. I don't see one weapon as different from the other. That's part of being in the trade, is one weapon and another weapon are just different ways of accomplishing the same task. But with the head chopping, with all that, it's so targeted that the person who's doing it has to take moral responsibility for it.
Yeah.
And that at least limits how much it can get done. That means it's going to be more like the French Revolution and less like Hitler's gas chambers. I mean, it's... I'm sorry that I don't have a solution.
They don't have the technological proclivities to be able to prove that. Well, at least that's what seems like with people like
oh,
ISIS.
Oh, no, that's not the case at all. ISIS... no, I've... I went to college for this at SNU. It's a political science degree called Law and Politics. And that's also the area of my concentration on my libertarian interests, like why I care about Lysander Spooner, for instance, is that peaceful cohabitation depends on people doing justice toward each other. Now, we can have a good fence between us and just stay on each other's side of the fence, and they can be Muslims over there, and we can be Christians or atheists or whatever over here, and we can not intermingle. But that means eventually we're going to have conflict. On the other hand, if there's intercourse between us, if there's trade, if there's America gives Hollywood to the world, and then India gives Bollywood to the world, and then Saudi Arabia or wherever loosens up culturally to the point where they can interact in an intelligent way with our culture, then it will be like the end of land war in Europe after World War II.
Can you elucidate me more kind of on the point, the last point you were making?
Well, I think that we can cohabitate. We have libertarian Muslims. There are a handful.
They
of,
are. It's an incredibly tiny amount. And the
I
amount,
that.
I mean, the amount well, of cognitive dissonance you need to have in order to be able to justify that, I believe, is a lot higher than as far as Christianity is concerned.
Oh, I don't think so at all.
Really?
Well, I have Christians in my life, and not all Christians are cut from the same cloth. I don't have faith in a supernatural being, but I do experience the emotion faith. And I do refer to the teachings of Jesus Christ as authoritative. Like, I have to live in a Western civilization where Jesus has been the rule for 2,000 years. That's, if I refuse to acknowledge that, if I refuse to work within that framework, that'd be like if I refuse to speak English to English-speaking people. If Jesus taught a good lesson, and I remember it because I was raised in church, and I can get somebody to act better by saying, hey, do you remember what Jesus said? That's
no,
a heck of a lot better than
again, I'm not disagreeing with that whatsoever. That's what I was stating. That with Islam, there's a lot more cognitive dissonance you have to deal with as far as being able to connect that with any kind of libertarian ethics in comparison to Christianity. I mean, Christianity, Jesus, a pretty good hippie. I mean, the stuff about hell, not so good on, but as far as his general message, a lot of that was kind of peaceful. When you go ahead and look at someone like Muhammad, you got a guy who married a six-year-old, raped her at the age of nine, lit a lot of people on fire because they didn't give him enough money, conquered tribe after tribe because he talked to himself while he was in a cave. I mean, the amount of violence within places like the Quran that is regularly justified, the martyrdom that is consistently justified, and martyrdom for absolutely no reason whatsoever. I mean...
Oh, no, no. Martyrdom for no reason whatsoever puts a value judgment on it that I don't think that you can make.
Well, heaven or hell. So you know, the best thing a believer can do is to die in war.
Yes.
And that's going to get you in a fantastic spot in heaven.
Right. No, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to believe at the right place and time. Like, at the Last Supper, this is, if I remember right, this is Luke 22:36, and if I'm wrong, somebody can beat me with Google. But at the Last Supper, Christ was giving what in the army we would call the safety briefing. Because for a very long time, the disciples had been under his direct care. They had done what he said, even though they didn't know what the point of it was, just like Mr. Miyagi would tell you wax on, wax off. Jesus would go and have masses of people consider the sparrows or consider the lilies. And if you look at Life of Brian, it's a pretty concise explanation of it. But the point is, though, that Jesus actually did something with that. Just like The Simpsons has used cartoons to teach basic moral lessons, like toleration for people. In the same way, Jesus taught basic moral lessons with the word equivalent of sock puppets.
Again, we are conflating the ideas and teachings of Jesus versus the teachings of Muhammad. And if we're going to be bringing up place and time, defensively, I completely agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm actually under attack and I'm talking to a group of people and stating the best thing that we can do is not necessarily sacrifice ourselves, but to defend ourselves against this competing tribe.
No, I understand that.
But with Muhammad, he was initiating coercion in all these different areas.
Oh, yeah. No, his behavior was more appropriate to his circumstances, and our behavior is more appropriate to our circumstances.
Like So if you want a war hawk culture, culture of conquering, then Muhammad is your man.
I mean,
that's your best
bet. I'm saying that the environment created the problem. I'm saying that Muhammad is like Hitler in that he's a synthesis of a warlike world that ended up creating someone who changed things by virtue of being the best at being violent, the way that Napoleon did or the way that Stalin did.
Yeah.
And so in Western civilization, thanks to the influence of Christianity, yes, we have had this peaceful influence, but we are the ones with more cognitive dissonance because we, collectively Western civilization, we're the ones with greater hypocrisy here, whereas the people on the other side, ISIS will say, or the bin Ladenite head choppers those people, air quotes, they don't have a contradiction. They have an enemy. They have somebody who bombed their mom or bombed their dad. And right now, war is peace.
That would be the case if a lot of the terrorists actually and suicide bombers came from places in which their parents were blown up or they were from an uneducated background.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of these suicide bombers are coming from places like the United States.
Oh, no. I think that
places like Britain and things like that. So, I mean, they're going to these places and they're not these poor, uneducated individuals who are choosing to do this.
I don't think they ought to be. I think that people who have more of Maslow's hierarchy of needs satisfied, but who don't have the whole package, are more dangerous. Timothy McVeigh was a Bronze Star winner. He was a decorated combat veteran, and he did more damage to innocent human life, than the federal government did at Waco. One man killed just as many innocent people, give or take, as a whole team of people screwing up and shooting machine guns into what amounted to a church.
Absolutely.
Army of one.
Well, what is kind of romantic about the idea that's being brought up by groups like ISIS is the idea that you can die for something.
Yes.
Right? You can feel something that viscerally, especially within that basically 16 to 26-year-old range, where you have a lot of people who are living in this nearly post-scarcity world that don't feel like they have any kind of drive to live. Mm-hmm. They have no great war, and this is the battle that they can have.
They do have a great war. That's it, though. That's the Orwellian Great War. You see, the thing about, and this is not my word, but jihad, struggle, internal struggle, is that it has everything to do with what Christ called the kingdom of heaven. Because the kingdom of heaven, your internal peace, whether or not you feel hell and torment when you close your eyes, or whether you close your eyes and, hear elevator music and feel generally good, that's dependent on how your life is. And you can't tell yourself to feel a different way in that sense. You have to walk the walk first and then feel like you are the good person that you know you are because you have values and you conform to those values.
But whenever you're discussing the inner struggle as far as jihad, there's some great writings on that. The vast majority of times where it's discussing jihad within the Quran and the Hadiths is about implementing war, coercion. I mean, it's not really an inner struggle if you're talking about how to properly rape women who you've just captured and enslaved.
But that's in the Bible.
Not within the New Testament. Again, I know. Here's the thing is I make the fucking same argument. Like, mm-hmm. I'm with you. The first 10 episodes of my damn show were kind of going into what are the problems of the Old Testament and everything. It's absolutely within there.
Right.
But I would state, though, that I veer away from the argument that whenever we discuss jihad, we're just discussing about some inner philosophical struggle like that Jesus would speak about, because yet again, I didn't see a lot of these statements being made by Jesus himself in comparison to someone like Muhammad.
No, I think Jesus just did it more concisely and more effectively because Jesus had a goal of getting people not to raise the sword, whereas Muhammad had a goal of inciting people. So to incite people, you have to give fiery speeches. But to incite people to think, you have to calm down and have them think about things with very small numbers, things they can understand first and then build from there. Because when Jesus made his statements about your sexual proclivities, if you look on a woman with adultery in your heart, it's as good as if you touched her or whatever. There's no reason that shouldn't apply to violence. He says, if your brother strikes you, you should turn the other cheek. Basically, in all areas of interpersonal violence where death and rape aren't involved, you would extrapolate that to say that you just let any man act out because he had bad parents or whatever, and you appeal to the law. You say, hey, fellow Jews, please judge this situation. Did I do something wrong, or is he wrong for hitting me? And that's the way that it ought to have worked according to Jesus's utopian perfect world. And our libertarian perfect world, or the one that, let's say, Robert Heinlein wrote about in The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, we had the same thing.
Yep. Oh, and again, I think we're agreeing actually in a lot of these issues. I actually want to get back to kind of our story regarding what occurred with you. But fascinating conversation though, because the thing is, you're taking from a specific point of view that I don't really think about very often.
Iraqis are folks, is the thing. Like, they're Muslims, but they're boring. They watch MTV. They eat the same food as we do.
Really?
You know, they just don't have bacon, and they don't sell beer in their stores. There's whiskey there. I found some while I was there. But they have a rule against eating bacon. They have a rule against drinking alcohol. They follow those two rules, and it doesn't seem to me like too many people go to church, which is sort of like around here.
Yeah.
So it's really hard for me to think of those people as extremists.
Yeah. But I mean, obviously the area has changed quite a bit since, I mean.
Well, no, because the people who are extremists in that culture correspond to the people who are extremists in our culture. The police, the three percenters, you know, the people who are fighting it out in Oregon right now. Those people are at the edge of violence in our culture. Like, we have a schism in our culture called the state wants to tell you what to do, and Americans don't like to be told what to do, and both sides have a lot of guns. So there is a potential powder keg, but luckily the fact that everybody's had so much metal between their hands for generations means that they actually have kind of a lot of temper, and they don't have a tendency to shoot it out frequently. Over there, they have to shoot it out frequently because they've tried everything else, and it ain't working.
What was your first combat situation that you had to deal with while you were there?
Let's see. Well, I'll just go straight to when I got blown up first, or the only time I got blown up, but it was the first real big one. I was in the Stryker infantry, so the vehicle is something like 25 tons. It's an armored personnel carrier that's designed to deliver infantry to the front line during an artillery barrage. The idea is you scare the crap out of the enemy by dropping bombs on him, and then by the time he realizes you're not dropping bombs on him, you're throwing grenades at him and shooting at him. And so this truck is designed to go into the most hazardous area, and when IEDs got reinvented, this truck became worth its weight in gold. And In June of 2006, it saved my life when we were hit by a suicide car bomb on the front left quarter of the vehicle.
So you hear the explosion going off.
Oh, I was taking a nap, dude. I heard the aftermath of the explosion. I'm in the belly of a vehicle. I'm taking a nap. I've got 50, 60 pounds of gear on, and I'm surrounded by, you know, my bros, and all I know is I'm tired and I want to get to chow. And the next thing I know, you know, my ears are ringing. I didn't hear the blast. I just know my ears are ringing. I was asleep during it. I had that tinnitus, like, ear ringing experience afterwards. And my mouth and lungs were full of a dust that was part sand and part, like, rusty metal. Because when the car blew up, all the parts of it that were rusted out pieces of metal basically powdered and went in the air. And so, you know, that kind of garbage is the first thing that was in my mouth and nose when I came to. And everyone around me is shouting, my ears are ringing. And so I look to my left, and my lieutenant's face is bleeding all over it. And it looks pretty bad, but it turned out not to be. And my vehicle commander's holding his hand. It's bleeding, but it doesn't look serious. But what was serious is my lieutenant couldn't hear because he had been out the air guard hatch in the vehicle, so his head was above the top of the vehicle, and his eardrums were temporarily blown out, and so was my squad leader. And so it was this sort of comedy of errors where I could hear my lieutenant yelling at my squad leader that my squad leader needed to take over because he couldn't hear, and so he couldn't command. And my squad leader was yelling that he couldn't hear, and so Sergeant Chavez was the NCO who had not been down, he hadn't been up, and he could see that this happened and immediately took over, and everything went click, click, click after that by the numbers. But oh my goodness, if it had been more than just a car bomb, if it had been followed on by a complicated attack, let's say if somebody had been shooting at us as well, something like that could have been a big damn deal. And that's the sort of thing that keeps you up at night. So I got out of that one perfectly, you know, fine with some hearing damage. And, you know, I don't know enough about TBI, and I'm not going to waste my time, you know, doing that until somebody actually knows something about it, can do something about it. But, yeah, that's the big one for me. Traumatic brain injury. You know, okay. Football concussion stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I was in a vehicle that got blown up, and now I have short-term memory problems sometimes. What are you going to do?
Not a lot.
Play dumb games, win dumb prizes.
Yeah. I hear things like MCT oil or something and help. Dr. Mark Gordon does a lot of stuff on that. But some interesting information coming out in regards to neurogenesis. But aside from that, so that was kind of the first time you had to deal with being blown up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you stated that wasn't the only time, though, correct?
Well, the other times that I was involved in combat were small arms fire, either us shooting at them, them shooting at us. I don't think two-way at any given point, though. It's just one or the other. And those were just, you know, one-off incidents where, I mean, it's life and death, but in the grand scheme of things, it wasn't even alarming because I was so well prepared for it.
Yeah. Now, you brought up how you realized in 2006 when you got there that WMDs probably weren't going to be an issue, though things like suicide bombing could be an issue and just war in general could be an issue. But what started stirring inside you that started to realize that maybe you had made a bad decision while you were there? Or was it even there, or was it afterwards?
I think the time that I began to put a strong moral judgment on it was around the time of Ron Paul 2008, when I was questioning my own, like, basic generic conservative beliefs about what the government ought to be doing, because I had never, let's see.
During 2008, you were still in Iraq?
Yeah, I did my second tour of Iraq from 2008 to 2009. And in that tour, I was at a different place in the infantry company, so I wasn't on the edge of the spear. I was actually, I was the company commander's radio man. So if you imagine a squire to a knight, it's kind of like that. His job is to be everything to everybody, and my job is to follow him around with a phone and make sure that he doesn't lose his hat or anything.
So not as heroic. Or at least it didn't feel as heroic.
Oh, no, it was wicked heroic, because what would happen is he would do ridiculous things, like jump off the truck with no weapon and no helmet, and I would be racing to follow him, because this CO went to West Point and wrestled for them, so he was... The PT test has a 300-point scale. He would have been over 400 on it. He was just a beast. He was almost a pro football player in terms of his athletic ability, and keeping up with him killed me. And then the fact that he was also West Point educated, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just being around pure leadership all the time. It was the same thing as the Boy Scouts all over again.
Yeah. So he kind of took you under his wing, kind of a thing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, he's the company commander. He takes all 130 people under his wing.
Like, yeah.
They're his children. Not this one, my other company commander, when we were in there 2006. I was a replacement. And so I showed up, I think, 8 months into my company's tour or something like that. It was supposed to be a 12-month tour. They got extended from 12 months to 16 months. But the big deal is they found out they were extended when we were supposed to be boarding the first handful of planes, hours before.
Oh, man.
And so that company commander had to make a tearful speech about how none of us were going home to his wife and kids. And, you know, somebody nudged me and pointed out that he had, I don't even know what he had. But the point is that your company commander is your father in a way. Like they say, there's no atheists in foxholes. The Army is your family. You either have them or you're alone in the world. And in the Army, I had great fathers. I just don't want to be exactly like them.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, getting back, though, you didn't quite tell us a lot about you heard in 2008 regarding Ron Paul, what was going on there, and how you were starting to feel as if maybe what you were doing was incorrect. I mean, were there specific incidences that you were dealing with while you were there that made you question what exactly the motive behind what was going on?
I don't. I think the place where my individualized experience matters actually is the education I underwent when I was in that second tour in Iraq, because being in that position where I wasn't in a line platoon, I managed my time very differently, and I had a lot of downtime that I spent reading. And so because of that, I became versed in what was going on both in and without America with regard to foreign and domestic policy in terms of government and the use of force, because that was my area of interest in the first place. I had intended to go into a career in law enforcement after the military, but I couldn't do it because of what I saw. Because what I saw, and the straw that broke the camel's back, was when I eventually read about the Waco massacre and learned, you know, at least the other side of that, the non-mainstream side of that. And so seeing all the errors and, you know, all the tragedy there, I knew that I could never go back to being a part of that after being part of the Iraq War. And that's when the light went on in my head, finally, that I had to stop being in the military. But, well, stop being on active duty, stop being in the infantry, stop hurting people directly. I had to talk myself out of it slowly, sort of like a minarchist talks himself slowly into anarchy. But yeah, the existence of another narrative where peace is an option and justice toward other people is an option, and we can live together if only we can figure out how to get along, and there's a way to figure out how to get along called I tell you, you tell me, we shake hands, or we don't. But that's how men deal with each other everywhere, if they aren't fighting.
Now, when they're not fighting, obviously, that's how things can be handled. What were some of the incidences, though, where you saw two men not exactly meeting eye to eye and having more than a few issues?
Well, the first one that comes to mind, I'm sorry, it's comedy, because I was on the side of it where we were the winners and they were the losers. And so what really comes down to, you know, me being the witness to a crime at the time, because of the environment I was in, I believed that what I had seen was wrong and I disapproved of it. But I was not in a position to make anything different by opening my mouth. So what I did was the best I could at the time. And now I don't have any remorse about it. What I have remorse about was just choosing to put myself in the situation where I was on a team against other people that I never met on somebody else's say-so. But that's the philosophy side. The meat and potatoes side is, it's cop stuff. One night, I think it was Baghdad, but I could be wrong, we were patrolling just to keep people from violating curfew because there was a whole bunch of violence. This was 2006, so this was some of the heavy sectarian violence time that I remember occurring. And so we were patrolling at night to keep people from being death squads or otherwise getting up to mischief, and we pulled over a guy on a moped. So imagine a 25-ton vehicle shining a spotlight at a little itty-bitty moped with one guy on it, and you can tell the power difference we're talking about. This is like a SWAT team against a kindergartner.
Yeah.
But when they pulled the guy off the moped, and I was just pulling security because that's what the lowest guy on the totem pole does, is he faces outward and makes sure nothing bad happens. I had a decent view. And so while I was doing my job, I was in a position to observe that they pulled the moped to one side of the street and the guy to the other. And while one NCO, or leader at least, was searching the vehicle, another was attending to making sure that the guy was being watched by the soldier who was guarding him. The guy just had his hands up, you know, a normal surrender position. But at one point, the leader who was searching the vehicle, the moped, found a Glock pistol and held it up in sight of the leader who was, at that time, walking away from the prisoner. He saw the pistol, became enraged, turned on a dime, extended the buttstock on his M4 carbine, and from out of the man's view, like blindsiding him, buttstroked him, I believe, on the cheek. So he just knocked him completely to the ground with 8 pounds of steel. And what was amazing to me was I was in the Bulldog Company, and we acted like it. There was another leader who was in a vehicle that had an open hatch. He saw that occur and he sprinted into it and turned what was one assault against one defenseless guy into a melee. And so when the two of them were done beating the man, I had the privilege of being in the truck near his head, admiring his bruises and pouring ice cold water on him, trying to keep him awake. Because before I was in the Army, I had the good fortune to be in the Boy Scouts and learn some first aid. So, while I was there and I did witness that, I contributed to making it better for the guy in the way that I knew how in the moment. And so the only thing I'm not proud of is what team I was on.
It all goes back to the fucking Boy Scouts, man. Jesus Christ.
That's why I can deal with all this, is because I had 12 years of prep that was designed by a guy who was an Army officer. He said, hey, we're not doing so good against these Dutch South African farmers. What can we do to make these boys better riflemen, better scouts, better whatever? And what he came up with is, let's learn from the Native Americans, the Native Africans, the Native whoever, how it is they used to do this stuff before we all lived in cities. And before we all lived in cities, they still had war. And they came up with a way of dealing with it.
Yeah. Now, you seem almost cavalier about that specific story. What were you seeing on a constant basis that was kind of sticking you in that mental spot? Because if you saw something like that occurring in America, I mean, I imagine that'd be kind of a more horrific type of a situation.
Well, I mean, in a place that there isn't a war on, yeah. But I mean, in inner cities and major cities, I'd expect to see that sort of thing with, you know, police and minorities, police and poor people all the time. And the reason for that is that the warlike mentality, you can't hate that much unless you're afraid. And so the police have to believe there's a war on police in order to behave with the level of violence that they do. And so too in Iraq, if there hadn't been IEDs, if there hadn't been snipers, if there hadn't been one or two people who really had, I mean, a friend of mine, I met after this happened, but it damaged him. He had been shot in the hip by a sniper below where his vest covered. And so he was in the hospital for months. And when he got back, he wasn't able to return to duty as an infantryman. And it seems to me like it would be like declawing a cat. You've got this person who's built their life around this identity, and now they have to quit for reasons completely beyond their control. And the amount of damage that I feel like that would do to the inertia of my life if it had happened to me, that kind of fear is why I was ready to kill at a moment's notice.
Yeah.
So, personally, my relationship with that didn't start when I met him, though. My relationships with that started right before I arrived in Iraq the first time in 2006. I had had a friend, my doc at the time, not my doc, but the only doc I knew, a medic, just another private, but he was, you know, a lot better trained than me and been in the Army for several months more than me. And so he knew his stuff and he became a close friend of mine because I needed some help getting along. Well, not so much. I just needed to know my up from down. The Army is a strange place for a new person.
Yeah.
But I got really close with him and he got to Iraq 2 weeks before me. And 1 week before I got there, a suicide car bomb drove up to a checkpoint that he was at, and he and his friends recognized it for what it was and they fired on it and he killed the driver, but the car bomb detonated anyway and he was injured. At least that's the way that I heard it. And when I came in contact with him later, he was that man who'd been through that thing. And by the time I even caught up with him and saw that he was at least physically sound, you know, he's a lot better adjusted than most people, I just knew that that could happen to anybody, including me. And I always knew that. And so when it did happen to me, you know, and I say I woke up to find out that I'd been blown up for the first time, the fact that it only happened to me once, that's just because the way my brain works. All my buddies have been blown up 3 or 4 times. It's just the culture we live in is life and death. You're on a tightrope and you'll kill or you'll be killed. And the fact that you might beat somebody up along the way is just a minor thing. That same doc one time, he was on a small kill team, which is something I'm really happy I thought to talk about. Small kill teams, their job is to lay in wait for the enemy to do something, like try to plant a roadside bomb. And so he was out with one that saw two Iraqis apparently digging by the side of a road to emplace a bomb. And so they shot at them with machine guns with night vision. And so you imagine a completely dark field, only, you know, green like in the movies with night vision. And you see the two people, and then you see the air lit up with white hot tracers. And so the bullets fill the air and you can't see the target. And these guys are in place and they're in a very small group. So they can't go down and check it out themselves. And they use their radio and bring in us. And I was on the quick response force at the time. And I knew it was my buddy Sanchez's platoon. And so when we went to go bail them out, basically to be their backup, We were looking for the people they shot up, looking to either find the bodies or finish the job. And we didn't find anything except, you know, some blood and nothing that you could go on because it was dark. And, you know, I'm not a Native American tracker or anything. That's just the way things are. You know, you're rolling the dice. You have no idea. You go into it with every night with the expectation that you don't come home. And at the end of that night, all I had was pants and boots that were covered in, you know, motor oil waste and raw sewage. And I missed a meal because I got turned away from the chow hall because they wouldn't let a guy as filthy as me in. So,
really?
That's the army for you. That's my experience is, you know, life and death and fear and human waste. And no, you're going to go hungry today.
Was there a kind of a view that the more horrific things you'd seen, the more character it's building in you? So people essentially, the men you were talking with, I mean, you share war stories. Did you ever feel like there was kind of a one-upmanship going on?
Oh, no. Well, I mean, it is true, but that's the way things work with temper. You know, the way that human temper works is as long as it doesn't break you, the worse the thing, the less you're going to flinch respond at the next one.
Yeah. So by repeatedly seeing these things, that means the next time you have to deal with it, the better off you're going to be.
Well, at least until the one that doesn't work out for you. But yeah. I think what it is you become habituated the same way that, you know, football players become habituated to large men running at them in a way that would probably make them become decent bouncers if they ever decided to quit their job. The nice thing about having a society full of people who know about violence is that if they're ethical people, they won't use any. Like after World War II, there was almost no political violence in the United States for an entire generation. You know, there was violence in terms of the stuff caused by the military-industrial complex. And, you know, there was the same Jim Crow that existed from before. But you didn't see the Cultural Revolution and the National Guard shooting it out with the college students, except in, what is it? Is it Athens, Tennessee, 1946?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's one incident where you do see a militia of veterans dealing with a corrupt political machine the exact way the Founding Fathers did. And so there is a historical reference for that there. But here, that's not what's called for, because here, what the problem is everybody's afraid of school shooters, and everyone's afraid of ISIS, and everyone's afraid of rape culture, or whatever it is that a particular person's problem with violence is, but they've got at their disposal this 0.45% of their population who've seen the elephant, who can do it for them. And, well, I did it for college money, so we work pretty cheap.
Yeah, you know, and that is an interesting point you're bringing up in regards to knowing the situation, having actually dealt with violence before. This is kind of the conversation I get in with people where I discuss, you know, my history doing Muay Thai kickboxing, boxing, jiu-jitsu, and things like that, was when you get into a safe scenario. I think of jiu-jitsu and things like that as kind of a safe scenario where you are struggling for life or death, but you know you can make it out, and there's not going to be a random IED that's randomly hit off. But you kind of understand the mindset. And when you do boxing, you understand what it can occur if you get punched in the face. And so when I was in conflict-type situations, I would know, hey, I should probably not deal with this situation. Like, I should walk away from this fight because I'm not trying to prove my manhood right now. I know I'm capable of this, but I'm also smart enough to know, say, if I'm in a bar or fight type situation, that someone can randomly hit me in the back of the head with a bottle, so I should probably try to veer away from this particular situation. If you understand the idea of violence and what that can mean, you earn a respect for it that I think a lot of other people don't have. It's kind of like when you get in discussions of the violent overthrow of the United States government. Now, I can understand the sentiment behind that, and it's possible that that may occur in the future. But some people, when I hear them talk theoretically about it, I know that they've never really seen violence more than, you know, than watching television. It's like, you know, there's a really good chance you're the one who's going to die, right? In the movie or in our scenarios, whenever we talk about post-apocalyptics, whether zombies or whatever, you know, status, it's always you who are the one who gets to live. Right? You're the main character in the movie every single time, and you disassociate yourself from the reality of the situation, which is that violence can lead to very unexpected results. And oftentimes they're not what you were expecting.
You know, this is too cavalier, but it's either I quote Eisenhower or I make something up. So I'm going to make something up. I don't know it myself, but I do sometimes do things like go to the American Legion for a beer, you know, meet some older veterans, hear their stories, find out that nothing new is under the sun. And the way I imagine it for them, I remember when Saving Private Ryan came out, I think it was in high school, but I remember hearing that World War II veterans had a problem watching it, especially the opening scene. And I just took it, you know, it was too intense or something like that. Now that I'm older and I'm not nearly as old as they were when this came out, I know for a fact that if I were to watch a movie like that about my experience, I would see an extra die and I would know that guy's name. That would be a human being to me. That would be somebody whose name should be in the credits, you know? If you watch Black Hawk Down, that's how that movie is. They tell you the name of every single person who died and what piece of ribbon they put on their coffin. And that's just the culture that I chose. That's, you know, that's the life.
Yeah.
I walked away from it, you know, just like somebody who thinks they're going to be gangster and then they figure out it's not all cracked up to be and then they leave. I did walk away from it, but, you know, it looks noble from a distance.
It certainly does. I mean, that's how it's sold to us. I mean, most great fiction is essentially apologetics for war. It's a push for it. It's, this is great. There is evil and there is good in the world. Now, I don't have a problem with using the term evil in specific scenarios. I'm not such a cultural relativist that I shy away from it. I believe there are actions which can be certainly classified as evil. A lot of those are done by the federal government, the United States federal government. And a lot of those are also done by jihadists and people in those other areas. What... Now, a point that I kind of brought up in the beginning of the show and something that you know, keeps hitting my mind is this idea that the way to deal with ISIS and these other jihadist organizations is essentially out-and-out warfare, blowing these people up, getting rid of them that way. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that you know, unless someone's actually talking about genocide, that it's practically an impossibility because you're going to leave people behind who now hate you more than, you know, the Muslims hated the Crusaders after that. But the other thing is they're not thinking very big. Like, there's the idealist side of political thought, and then there's the realist side of political thought, especially in international relations. And if we're going to profess to be a Christian nation collectively, just for the fun of it, we'll say that, Jesus would love his enemies. Jesus would go sit down to dinner with them. He'd break bread and, you know, they'd talk. And that would preclude violence because he'd go to them without a weapon in hand. But the way that America does business is it goes everywhere in the world, sword in hand, just like Pax Romana. And so if your relationship with the world is that all roads lead to Rome and all taxes go to Rome and all glory goes to Rome, then, you know, when you have a fall, all the barbarians are going to come to Rome looking for recompense against all the wrong that's been done to them. You know, they're not warlike barbarians against Rome because of anything other than Rome came into their territory and conquered them. If they had been left alone, they'd be warlike barbarians against each other, maybe. But America collective that doesn't exist, you know, this 300 million people or this federal government that, you know, says it represents them, their chickens are going to come home to roost, or people are going to act better. I'd like to see people act better. I'd like to see people try to get along. I'd like to see people try to understand each other and try to find the common ground that's going to give them some reason to have intercourse as friends, as business partners, whatever. But there need to be roads between people's houses, or else they can't be friends. And the less frequently they're tread, the more weeds will grow, you know, the less we'll know about each other. We have the internet. We have the opportunity to talk to each other with the Philosophy of Liberty video and stick figures. I mean, putting that into Arabic should be like a 20-minute project if somebody speaks it, right? I just don't. That's not my job, you know. My job is to tell you what I saw and to try to convince other people not to join the army and just generally to try to think of a way to act toward each other that isn't aggressive.
You know, honestly, I'm very grateful that you came on the show in order to be able to kind of talk about, you know, your stories and the things that you saw. Now, you're pretty well spoken on this subject. I mean, I know there's former Army guys who I've met. A lot of them came from actually the Ron Paul Revolution thing. That's the most explosive amount of people that I've actually seen come from that. I didn't put it well enough into context whenever I saw Ron Paul kind of blooming back in 2008, because I was kind of already an anarchist and I was doing the whole, if you're in politics, you're a statist and you suck and you're going to do nothing for liberty. But the amount of, you know, former soldiers that I saw who had changed their mind about a lot of things because of him was really important. Have you had much contact with people that you worked with when you were in the Army, and have you kind of talked to them about some of these ideas?
Oh yeah, I make a point of trying to stay in touch even with the people who I really disagree with. Because these people are my brothers, it's like I'm trying not to ruin Christmas. I'm willing to meet them where they're at, even though some of the things that they think hurt my feelings, to be frank. But a lot of the people that I've grown with, like the same, a Free Stater that I know right now is the brother of a guy I was reading those books with in 2008. We were at Bastiat together. We were at Ayn Rand together. I came away an atheist. He came away a Christian, but we agree on the use of force. So, you know, hopefully now that the move is triggered, his name is somewhere in the book and he moves in the next 5 years. Fingers crossed.
And by the way, the triggering the move, the Free State Project, yada, 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 they finally have 20,000 signers. So people are going to be coming out here soon to be dealing with that. Now, when it comes to talking to soldiers, though, you know, I know a lot of people who are libertarians, myself included, who have said things like, you know, soldiers are welfare whores and other comments that I probably wouldn't suggest people throwing out willy-nilly as often as I used to. I mean, I was 18. I was kind of an asshole, to be quite honest. I'm still kind of an asshole, to be quite honest. How would you recommend, though, people kind of have this kind of conversations with either people who are still in the military right now or people who have recently left?
Actually, right now, I'm really working on trying to meet people where they're at. And so the way that I'm doing that, because I'm doing it the Army way, if I tell you the Army way, maybe if somebody tried to talk to somebody from the Army way, they would impress them so much that that person would listen.
So teach me.
Yeah, I'm really annoyed with the idea that you can't tell people anything, because I really like to tell people things.
Yeah.
But I've got a problem with getting people to listen to me. What I learned from my company commanders, though, and from other, you know, good leaders in the Army, is that you can be and you can show and you can do, and then people are going to follow. So if you be in the right place at the right time with the right uniform, standing up the straightest, you know, talking loud and proud and telling people how it's going to be, they'll believe you. I don't care if you're a car salesman or a company commander or whatever. You know, human beings listen to people with confidence. And so if you can inspire and motivate people by being excellent and showing what it is to be excellent and be proud of that excellence, to enjoy self-esteem, they'll do it. That's what Nike sells.
Yeah. So essentially, if you're going to be wanting to sell the idea of liberty or the liberation of mind, don't be some guy who's 350 pounds complaining that every single thing in the world that's wrong is because of someone else, and at the same time calling the guy who just got back from war a faggot welfare whore who needs to burn in hell, and that he wished that someone else had killed him.
I'll tell you what, actually, it's people exactly like, imagine, you know, the terrible basement-dwelling libertarian.
Yeah.
But then take that person and turn them into a doer. Don't change anything. Keep them nerdy. Make them, like, into collecting swords or whatever, and reading nerdy books and wearing a Hawaiian shirt or whatever. You know the guy, I mean. That guy met me where I was at the day I showed up from Iraq. I took a little time off to do a little squirrel hunting down in Arkansas and spend some time with my military family, but when I got here, man, I was kind of a wreck, and the people at the Church of the Sword, they've got this hokey Jedi, you know, Hunter S. Thompson Gonzo, you know, religion going on, and it's exactly as much faith as you want. Come drink their beer, come hit them with a foam sword. It's like Fight Club, but without any real bruises. That was where I was at years ago, and I'll tell you what, it's still where I'm at, but I'm a lot more mature now, and I want to give it to other people. Because all dudes in the Army need is something to do with their bros on the weekend. and all dudes out of the army need something to do on the weekend with their bros and maybe some therapy and a drink a little less.
Yeah. So speaking of that, and if you don't want to talk about this, I can completely understand. But the topic of post-traumatic stress disorder is obviously highly talked about, especially from people who are coming back from the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and just war in general. I mean, I know I wrote about post-traumatic stress disorder that I had just from dealing with Child Protective Services, which honestly I think is, in a way, nothing compared to what you had to deal with in Iraq. And do you feel you were a victim of PTSD, or that it was something that you had to deal with?
See, I don't think that I have PTSD because that has disorder in it. And what I am versed in and ready to, you know, talk about with authority is combat stress, because it's something I was prepared to experience and something I experienced and something that I came back from and that I've had a lot of time to grow to understand. Because, I mean, it's a perfectly normal thing that you go through that experience and that it changes you and that you're now adapted to this traumatic experience that you're in. And I don't have disorderly behavior. I don't shine my shoes because I've always been that kind of soldier that doesn't want to. But I don't know. I went and got my degree in the exact amount of time with the exact GPA that I expected. And I felt like I was keeping it together and being polite to a bunch of people who, you know, in the Army would have called them dumb or, you know, made fun of them or whatever, because they just don't know the outside world beyond school. But getting along is important. And as long as I do that, that's orderly.
What did you gain from the military that has helped you now in spreading a message of peace?
It's faith. The thing that the people, well, I don't talk about other people, I'll talk about me. I'm certain that war is terrible and we ought not to ever do it again. And I'm certain that taxation is theft and that if I need alms, I can get them from my neighbors who like me because I've been nice to them or pity me because something bad happened in my life. And so that certainty that people are good and that I'll be able to get along if only I try to get along, that means that I never need to pick up the sword or the knife or the gun again. And I never need to ask anyone else to do it on my behalf. I approve of Prometheus for teaching people how to use fire. I approve of, you know, gun instructors for teaching people self-defense. Those people are beyond reproach. Nobody can say anything bad about a gun instructor unless they're a bad teacher. But cops and soldiers don't have clean hands. That includes me. And so, to wash my hands of it, I have to tell the truth about how I feel about what I saw. And so many people saw that, thanks to the internet, thanks to blogs, thanks to the fiction that I see some veterans writing. We have this opportunity to study war as an idea, not a thing that we really do. Just like football. We can put it in a box. We can contain it. We can call it an emergency kit plan that we're never going to use. And the way that we do it is the people who mean it, you let them tell you about it and you listen to their authority. The centurions were the ones who came to Jesus first. The veterans are the ones who came to Ron Paul first. Everybody else is going to need to come around. They're going to need to support our troops after the fact. Because my generation's not going to be a Vietnam generation. We have the internet. We know how to read and write. We have Western civilization. We have liberal educations. It would be a real pity if two generations of veterans in a row went, I don't want to say to waste. I mean, there's so many wonderful people. But if there were two tragedies in a row, if we didn't have one of them be a comedy where we say, hey, I'm glad we got over that. That'd be nice. That'd be a good story. I'd like to write that one.
Well, thank you very much, Josh, for being on the show. It was, I think a lot of people learned from this. Yeah, I want you back on at some point. You really speak on this subject in a great manner. And the way by which you are educating us on this particular subject is incredibly important. And I think more people need to hear it from people who actually have been to war.
Thank you, Carlos. Oh, I'm just so happy that before you left, we got a chance to sit down in your wonderful studio and do this. Because to think that all the wonderful conversations that we've had have just been between your ears and my ears, Yeah, I'm going to get a big ego and say I'm happy we did this. I'm glad that somebody else is going to hear this for once.
Cool.
It can't be just between us.
Yeah, about like 10,000 people or so will hear this. So it'll be a pretty cool thing. Of course, you can find everything at libertarian-atheist.com. Is there anywhere or any books you'd want to recommend to people or blogs, or have you had any writings done?
No, I'm not an authority on what's good.
No true statement could be said about me either. Alrighty, folks. I will talk to you all soon.